our rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, happy Monday. Happy President's Day. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to North Carolina, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, Live365's AmericanFM.com, and others. Oh, and cable radio network, we can't forget. We're in cable systems in 29 states. Anyhow, welcome back to our program, Welcome back to this week of the program. Every now and then there's a person out there. You know, as those of you who are regular listeners to this program know that we don't do a lot of guests on this program. But every now and then there's somebody out there who has something extraordinary to bring to the conversation and has a track record of being absolutely right when they predict things, generally based on knowledge that they have. That when I saw a news story, when a news story went flying by me, last night, this morning, I had to get on the phone to Scott Ritter and say, is this true? Could this be? And I want to share this. I want to share Scott with you all. So Scott Ritter is with us. He is a former Marine major who served as chief of the Concealment Investigations Unit in Iraq for the United Nations Special Commission. That's UNSCOM from 1991 to 1998. Otherwise known as like the head weapons inspector guy, I guess. He's the author of Endgame, Solving the Iraqi Problem Once and for All, back in 1999. He has a new book coming out this summer called Iraq Confidential. Scott, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you back on the program, Scott. You were quoted as saying that the United States, that George W. Bush has, quote, signed off, end quote, on plans to bomb Iran in June of this year of 2005. Is that accurate?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't put quotes in front of that and on the end of it, but the gist of it is that according to information that I've been made aware of, the president has been presented with an option to launch debilitating airstrikes against Iran in June. And he has okayed that option to be continued.
Yeah. Now, I'd like to drill this down a little bit deeper with you, if we can. Harari, this fellow who was assassinated in Lebanon.
Former Lebanese prime minister.
Right. When this happened, the first question that occurred to me is who would benefit from his death? I mean, that's typically the first question you always ask when there's, you know, whether
it's... Right, and one of the biggest answers that come out is that the Syrians do not benefit in any way from his death.
Well, in fact, the exact opposite. The Syrians are the ones who would be the most harmed by his death.
That's right. So it's just ludicrous in the extreme. And you have to be suspicious when immediately the United States and organs associated with the United States start screaming about Syrian complicity.
Yeah.
It's mind-boggling that the media not only parroted this, but did so in an unquestioning manner.
It strikes me that the major beneficiaries of Harari's death, of the consequences of his death, I mean, you could argue that Syria might benefit from his death because he was opposed to Syrian occupation, but he wasn't in power anymore. He was a private businessman. He's a billionaire. He's got lots of business enemies. I mean, there's all these other possible intrigues, but... I mean, you could argue that because he's taken this position, they want to take him out. But it's not. We're not. This isn't the mafia here. I mean, this is international relations. We're talking about, you know, the casus belli. We're talking about the justification for war. But it does seem that there are two parties, and conceivably three, that would benefit tremendously from the fallout of his assassination, particularly if the fallout of that assassination involved implying that it was Syria. The first being the neocons in the Bush administration, the hawks who want an excuse to attack Syria and Iran. The second being al-Qaeda, who want us to attack Iran and Syria because, you know, they've been playing George Bush like a fiddle ever since 9/11. And the third might be Israel. Although I want to put that one off to the side because I think that that's just there's too many conspiracy theories around that one. It seems to me like this these first two are the they're the other region in the interest in the region that is closely aligned with us.
Well, I'll
what are your thoughts on that?
Put it this way: as much as I dislike the Bush administration and what they do, I don't believe we are at the point yet where our secret intelligence organs are carrying out assassinations for political purposes. There's a difference between knocking off an Al-Qaeda operative using a Predator with a Hellfire missile in Yemen. That's an assassination, but that's against a terror target.
Yeah.
There's a huge difference between that and killing somebody to create a political crisis that can then be exploited. I know there are people in the Bush administration low down who have said this is the sort of thing we should be doing. But
right. And we did in Vietnam when we assassinated Diem, did we?
Correct. Know? But this requires a presidential finding. Remember, in Vietnam, it was pre-church, church
before
hearings
the church
in the 70s.
Commission, yeah.
Congress has assumed a number of oversight responsibilities which cannot be bypassed by law. And I would have a hard time believing that the president has signed a covert finding that has been briefed to Congress that permits this kind of assassination capability. So
I have to agree with you.
I'm one that would like to put, no matter how much I want to implicate the Bush administration on bad things, I want it to be honest implication. And this, let's remember this about Harari. He's a man with a past. This is a man that took billions of dollars of Saudi Arabian money that was earmarked for the rebuilding of Lebanon, and he put it in his pockets and he paid off his friends. This is a very corrupt individual who, through the course of his time as prime minister, made a lot of enemies. And there's a lot of people out there who want him dead. And it seems to me that his past caught up with him, that we might be able to write off this tragic death of not just Harari, but nine people who died during the attack as a byproduct of Lebanon's civil war ravaged past, as opposed to trying to create some sort of, spy versus spy scenario.
Well, what do you think about the possibility? And I don't disagree with you. In fact, I would be horrified to discover that the Bush administration had anything to do with this, and I frankly don't believe that they did.
There's a big difference between actually pulling the trigger on Harari and then taking advantage.
I was just going to say. However, the Osama bin Laden, or not even bin Laden. I mean, just the fundamentalist Sunnis in the Wahhabists in that region who are aligned with the philosophy of bin Laden and his mentor.
Al-Qaeda does not operate in Lebanon. Lebanon is the hunting ground of Hezbollah.
Well, Hezbollah runs the show there.
Hezbollah definitely runs the show there, and Hezbollah makes, what I like to remind people, first of all, is Hezbollah is closely linked to Syria,
right,
and Iran. Therefore, Hezbollah is not going to allow the trigger to be pulled on an event that would be detrimental to Syria, Iran, and Hezbollah.
Right. Well, that's my point. I mean, Hezbollah runs Lebanon. The United States runs the United States. Al-Qaeda came into the United States and knocked down the towers. But what if Al-Qaeda went into Lebanon and blew up this guy?
The Hezbollah has a tighter control on Lebanon than we had of our borders in 2001.
So you think that's unlikely? You think that this really is just some part of his past, something that has nothing to do with international geopolitical considerations?
I think this is Harari's corrupt past coming back to bite him.
And the Bush administration is going to exploit it.
They're going to exploit it to the nth degree, and they already have. I mean, Syria is guilty of a number of things that I wouldn't mind us paying attention to. They're guilty of harboring the insurgency in Iraq. They're harboring some of the leaders. They're participating in some of the logistics support efforts. And as an American who has, you know, loyalty to our troops, I want to make the situation as safe as possible for our troops, which means we need to do what has to be done to prevent support coming over the border to the insurgents. And Syria is a base of support, so I have no problem leaning on the Syrians in that regard. But I'm not one to fabricate excuses. And what I see with the Harari link is
why don't we just close the Syrian border?
Well, we can't close it. We don't have enough troops to close
it. It's too big.
Border.
It would be like closing the Mexican border here.
It's much more daunting than even closing the Mexican border. We have 135,000 troops in Iraq right now, and we can't maintain a sufficient level of security if we divert the troops to the borders. First of all, which border are we going to close? Because they're all porous.
Yeah. Well, you're right. I was suggesting with Syria, but boy, a complex situation. Well, the other point that was made in this article that Mark Jensen wrote in United for Peace in Pierce County, Washington, was that when you were there, you had made the comment that the U.S. manipulated the results of the recent January 30th elections in Iraq. What did you mean by that?
Well, just that. I think we can see a U.S. hand in this election from start to finish. But one has to be very suspicious of the outcome of this election. A percentage I ask everybody to look at is the 48% figure given for the Shia vote.
Mm-hmm.
That's significant because had they received 51%, then there would be no debate about the formation of the government. It was imperative for the United States to keep that figure below 50%. And when you took a look at the delayed findings of the election, when you realize that there are villages that have a certain number of villagers involved that are producing more votes, and you have Donald Rumsfeld flying in to make sure that everything is A-OK with the certification, this all
sort of seems like Ken Blackwell in Ohio, right?
Well, it's worse than that.
Yeah.
This is America. You know, it's one thing to play domestic political games, and it is criminal. If things in Ohio went bad the way some people say it did, you know, that's a criminal act, but that's an American criminal. That's something that we need to take care of internally.
Mm.
But here we are using the terminology of democracy, the vision and the promise of democracy, and we apply it to Iraq, and all we've done is pervert it.
Yeah, we have to do it right. Scott, we're out of time. I so much appreciate your coming on and sharing your thoughts with us. It's always great to hear from you. Scott Ritter, his new book, Iraq Confidential, will be out this summer. Scott, thanks again.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon. 20 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program.
Attention, Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. A few inches of snow here in the People's Republic of Vermont on this President's Day. A remarkable, beautiful day, however. No sign of Thomas Jefferson. But the place where I last saw him now has about 4 feet of snow on top of it. I got to tell you a story. A couple of years ago, it must have been about a decade ago. Those of you who are news junkies probably know exactly when it was. I don't have the date right in front of me. It had to be more than 10 years ago, though, or that in that neighborhood, because it was when we lived in Atlanta. And one of my books had come out on attention deficit disorder. And CNN had scheduled me to be on their morning show. It was Morning with Sylvia or something like that. There was this morning show that CNN had, where they were trying to compete with the Today Show and all that. And they wanted me to come on and talk about ADD and all this stuff. And I went down to CNN the night before, and we did this kind of little rehearsal thing and all this stuff. And I was supposed to be down at the studio the next morning at 7 a.m. I think we went live at 8, as I recall. And about 6:15, right around 6 o'clock in the morning, just as I'm getting ready to leave the house and head down to CNN, I get a phone call from the producer of this program on CNN, this TV program. And she says, well, you know, we're going to have to cut your segment out today. I'm really sorry. But the Lorena Bobbitt trial is going live this morning. And we're going to preempt our programming and just run Lorena Bobbitt. And then there was a pause, and she kind of chuckled, and she says, "I guess you could say you're the second guy to have been cut by Lorena Bobbitt." What reminds me of this story is this bizarre, this story here in Anchorage, Alaska. This woman, she did the same thing. But here's the mistake: the man agreed to be tied to a windowsill as part of their relations, and she used a kitchen knife to chop it off, and then went and flushed it down the toilet. The crews came out, and they ripped the toilet up, got it back, took him to the hospital, reattached it, and time will tell how he does. But boy, every now and then these scary things happen. Every man in the audience is cringing right now. We'll move along. Why Bush will fail in Europe. George W. Bush is in Europe right now. You'd have to be living on Mars not to know it. I was this morning, MSNBC, it just absolutely startled me. I mean, the woman for MSNBC who, I don't want to name names here, but who was traveling with the president, comes on. Oh, what the heck, it was Nora O'Donnell. And she comes on and she says something to the effect of, President Bush isn't standing back from or isn't standing down from confronting a difficult situation. And I'm like, you know, was that press release written by the GOP or by the Bush campaign? I mean, that's not how reporters, we have reached this point in America where we are so into news speak, and the big news organizations, particularly those owned by huge multinational corporations, are so in bed with this administration, the Republican Party, that even a news story comes across as a commercial for the heroic manhood of our president. I guess it is an interesting segue to the previous story. In any case, the folks in Europe have some serious thoughts on George W.'s speech this morning, his comments. BBC put up a website to allow people to comment. I'm going to share some of their comments with you, give you my take on it. William Pfaff's take on it is published in The Guardian today. And what will be the outcome of this? What is the future of American relations with Europe? Is there a future after all the damage that has been done by the Bush administration, you know, setting us back at least back to the conflicts that came out of the Spanish-American War, I'd say. Well, you could argue, you know, we had conflicts with Europe during World War I and World War II, but they were, let's say, resolved in a friendly way, ultimately. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 27 minutes before the hour, our program brought to you today by DemocraticMatch.com and Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com, 1-800-511-MACS, as in Max, as in Macintosh. Although Small Dog can help you out with just about anything. 1-800-511-MAX for Small Dog Electronics. Be sure you say hi from us. And DemocraticMatch.com. As well as other sponsors that you hear. Please patronize the sponsors of our local radio stations and let them know that you heard the program here. And I'd like to mention also our web stream. White Rose Society now has a 24-hour a day, 7-day-a-week stream just of the Tom Hartman program. So if you go to our page on whiterosesociety.org, there's a link to it off the Tom Hartman program, you know, just tomhartman.com or whiteroesociety.org. You will find this show, whatever the most recent show is, it is running continuously, 24 hours a day. So anytime you want to listen to it, you can listen to it. And as well as radiopower.org doesn't run our program continuously. They have a wide variety of excellent, excellent progressive programming. But they also repeat our show several times throughout the day. So excellent sources there for you. 1-866-889-8894, by the way, is our telephone number. The website, tomhartman.com. If you want to drop by our chat room, just click live chat, and it will get you there. So William Pfaff in The Guardian yesterday publishes this article, Why Bush Will Fail in Europe, and raises what I think are really two really very important points. And then I want to share with you what the BBC has to say about this. First, we'll hear what Rick in Michigan has to say about it too. We get to that in just a second here, Rick. Bush wants, Pfaff suggests, Bush wants more help from the Europeans in Afghanistan and Iraq. Well, yeah. Okay. So from the European perspective, first of all, George W. is coming over there with his hat in his hand going, please help us out. I put my foot in this hole and I can't pull it out. So it kind of like the old, was it an Uncle Remus story or was it an Aesop's fable? I think it was an Aesop's fable. The story about the way to catch a monkey is to have a jar with the mouth on the jar that is narrower than the rest of the jar, just narrow enough that a monkey can fit his empty hand into it. And you put a whole bunch of candy or goodies or nuts or something in the jar, and the monkey will reach in and grab them and then try and pull them out, but you can't get his hand out because it's full of the nuts or the candy. And the jar, of course, is attached to something, and now you've got the monkey. And you can walk up and tranquilize him or tie him up in a rope or whatever, and he's just not going to let go of that candy. But even though he's trapped by his own, so here we are. I mean, this is a marvelous metaphor, I think, in some ways, for what's going on with our situation in Iraq and Afghanistan. We are now the owners of what has become the largest narco-terrorism state in the world, Afghanistan. They are outproducing, however much cocaine Colombia produces, Afghanistan is producing more heroin. And heroin, of course, is far more, vastly more addictive than cocaine. Speaking of which, by the way, last night Hunter S. Thompson committed suicide. And perhaps a little later on in the show, we'll read a little clip from one of his books in memory. He's what a great author, a brilliant man and a brilliant reporter. I mean, a pioneer. But back to this topic. Pardon the digression. So here we have this failed narco state, Afghanistan, and the former oil executive, Hamid Karzai, has pretty much just control of the main city, of Kabul. Not even all of Kabul. And there are these narco-terrorist warlords, and there's about a dozen major ones that have divided up the country among themselves and ordered people in their regions to go to the democratic elections and vote for them so that they can continue to run the country. We've got that, a small problem. And on a per-soldier basis, deployment to Afghanistan is actually more dangerous than Iran, or Iraq, rather. I mean, we have more people dying in Iraq. But for, the number of people per 1,000 or per 100,000 who die on any given month or week or year or whatever is actually higher. Your probabilities of dying are higher as a percentage of the number of troops deployed if you're in Afghanistan right now, then in Iraq. A very real statistic that very much is not in the news. It's very, largely ignored. So we've got that kind of problem. Although it seems to be settling down in as much as we've allowed the narco-terrorists to just kind of go about their business, which is really upsetting the Europeans, by the way. They're having a massive problem with cheap heroin flooding Europe because, you know, this is just contiguous. I mean, you don't need to cross an ocean or anything to get it, to get the, I mean, Afghanistan historically was the source for most of Europe's hashish, all the famous stories and, you know, from the 60s and everything, the hashish trail. It has now become the source for this very cheap heroin. Heroin is down to the equivalent of maybe $4 or $5 U.S. per hit, per dose in Europe, from 5 years ago where it was $15, $20. And this cheap and easy availability is fueling an epidemic of heroin addiction in Europe and in the United States, by the way. So we've got that problem. We have that problem. And then we have the problem of Iraq, of course. And our soldiers, you know, playing the roles of, tragically, of sitting duck, an average of about 3 a day dying over there now. We've got the problem, or what we see as a problem, of the European Union, and not just the European Union, but the Russians and the former Soviet states cutting deals, those that have oil and natural gas, cutting deals with China to provide China with that oil that we want from the Caspian Sea region in exchange for weapons that China wants that we say we would rather they didn't have, even though we let them make parts for our missiles. Right? It's like, it's reached a point where, you know, we're Chinese chips. You can't build an aircraft carrier now without stuff from China. Used to be you couldn't do it without stuff from Japan. That was bad enough, but I mean, this is, so there's that number one. Number two, Pfaff points out, the definition of crisis. And this is, you know, we've talked about this before on this program, this the power of nightmares, that the movie, there's a TV show, three-part TV documentary that ran on BBC's Channel 4, in October of last year and then was again repeated about a month ago, as I recall. In which they basically say, hey, you know, we Europeans, we've been putting up with this stuff forever. I mean, the British and the IRA, the Italians and the Red Brigades, the German and the Bader-Meinhof gang, and the Basque separatists, and the Spanish. I mean, we know about terrorism. The November 17 group in Greece. And on a per capita basis, England has certainly suffered more at the hands of the IRA than we have at the hands of Al-Qaeda. And so they look at us reacting to 9/11 and they say, aren't you guys being just a little bit hysterical? I mean, these guys, you know, you get some criminals attacked you. Go after them. Let's get together and get the criminal. But, you know, declaring war on Saddam Hussein because some Saudis attacked you? Don't get it. Sorry. To quote Pfaff, he says, few Europeans either believe in the global war on terror or the war against tyranny, as Washington describes them. American claims about the threat of terrorism seem grossly exaggerated, and the American reaction disproportionate and even hysterical. 3,000 were killed in the Twin Towers, but most advanced societies have already had or still have their own wars with terrorism, in quotes, sustaining losses proportionately as severe. The British with the IRA, the Italians and Germans with the Red Brigade, and so on. He says it's been a condition of modern political existence. Second problem is that it's the official doctrine now of the Bush administration that there only be one nation that have control of the world, and that be us. Condi Rice, 2 years ago, told the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London that multipolarity, that is more than one major power in the world, in the past had been, and you know, quoting Condoleezza Rice now, a necessary evil that sustained the absence of war but did not promote the triumph of peace. So this is Pax Britannica. We will have world peace when the British Empire rules the world. It's Pax Romana. We will have world peace when the Roman Empire rules the world. It's Pax Americana. We will have world peace when the United States rules the world. Hey, would you like to be our friends? And the folks in Europe are starting to say, We've heard this talk before. There was this guy back in the 1930s who said that he was going to create a 1,000-year reign of peace by ruling the world. We've heard this kind of rhetoric, and we have even stupidly engaged in it ourselves. The British will say, well, and for that matter, the Spanish and the French, they've all tried their hand at empire, even the Portuguese. And the Romans, of course, the Italians, they're familiar with this. And they're all saying to us, didn't you guys learn a lesson in 1898 in the Spanish-American War? I mean, didn't you get it? And Bush is, apparently not. So the BBC has a website. U.S. President George W. Bush is in Brussels at the start of a 5-day diplomatic tour of Europe and will meet with several European leaders, including Tony Blair. Oh, excuse me. It says Tony Blair. Can President Bush rebuild bridges in Europe? What should be Mr. Bush's priorities in Europe? Send us your views using the form on the right. The following comments reflect the balance of opinion we've received so far. And then they have responses. Now, they weight these things. The BBC, you know, if they get 50 letters that say Bush is a creep and one that says he's wonderful, or let's say 50-50, then every other letter will be, you know, he's wonderful, he's a creep, he's wonderful, you know, what a, just to hypersimplify here. Let me just share with you the first clips from the first 7 out of 8. Okay, so this represents about 90% of British opinion. The first, it's not a matter of Mr. Bush mending fences with Europe. Few in the U.S. really care about Europe or their views. It's really a matter of Europe falling in line with U.S. policies. The second, he can try, but he will eventually fail. The European public is much more educated and informed than the American public, exclamation point. So I think Europe should take a stance and not shake to America's willpower. Here's another one. This is from Jeanette in the U.K. She says, no, of course not. Everyone knows Bush is only making this gesture now because he needs European help. Superficially, there'll be lots of smiles and handshaking, but deep in their hearts, the major European leaders have absolutely no respect left for Bush. This one from Ian. They actually give the names and locations and stuff on the site. Rhetoric from the Bush administration has convinced a percentage of Americans that old Europe is antiquated and short-sighted. Before he can mend bridges, George W. Bush, really needs to repair the American viewpoint. Nothing he says in Europe will sound sincere while his supporters at home continue to boycott France and eat freedom fries. And Mick in Leeds in the UK says, a president who does not have the full support of Americans can, of course, rebuild bridges with some politicians in Europe. The president cannot rebuild bridges with the majority of Europeans who believe the current U.S. administration is not interested in peace in the world. Well, and here's one more. Christine in the UK. That depends. Is he going to admit that he made mistakes and that he shouldn't have accused independent European democracies of sponsoring terrorism? Or is he going to pretend that he did nothing wrong? That seems to be the opinion being issued in the UK. Let's find out what it is here in the United States. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line, listening on WTKG. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program.
Good day to you.
Thank you.
Comment there. I was talking to the screener and said that.
That is Rama Schneider, by the way.
Rama, talking to Rama.
Rama drove through the snowstorm today to show up and hang out and help us out here.
Well, good thing to be driving through a snowstorm for. he said you had not yet touched on these tapes that Mr. Bush's friend Doug Weed had apparently made public.
Yeah, I haven't brought
that
topic up yet.
The reason I want to talk about it is not so much because of Mr. Bush or Mr. Weed. It's just that I called the local largest radio station in this area earlier today, which is on from 9 to 12 before you're on. And what amazes me about all this is that anything George Bush does, now apparently he alluded without actually saying so that he had tried marijuana as a youngster, whatever his definition of youngster is, could
yep.
be 35.
Yeah,
but the amazing thing is that
and cocaine as well, by the way.
Right, the folks that call in here in the West Michigan area are pretty much of the Dutch Calvinist tradition, and you know somehow or other, if a person like me who's a Christian but also a liberal doesn't care for Bush, it doesn't matter that I say I'm basically in favor of things like prayer in schools or Ten Commandments being on display, and I'm against gay marriage and I'm against abortion, and I think Jesus is my Lord and Savior. None of that matters if I criticize George Bush. And it's almost like a cultic following that these folks in the evangelical churches have got involved
with. It's not just there, Rick. What you're identifying is the my team, your team mentality, and it's what I try to stay away from in this program and what many other programs just hyper-promote. On Thursday, I listened to the first 15 minutes of Rush Limbaugh's show last week. He used the word hate in the context of liberals twice in the first 15 minutes.
Oh, sure.
It's like creating this idea that there's our side that's always right, their side that's always wrong, and that they're bizarre and they're, you know, it's not a useful thing. There's much more that binds us in common than that separates us. And I think we all need to wake up to that. 10 minutes before the hour. Thanks, Rick, for the call.
Who is it?
Special.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Go.
If you want a crown course in reality, you get yourself a working man's PhD.
Yes, indeed. Get yourself a working man's PhD if you want to know about reality. That's, isn't it? There was this extraordinary moment this weekend. Bernie Sanders hosted the presentation of a movie called Orwell Rolls Over in His Grave in the local theater here in Montpelier, Vermont. And after the movie, he got up, and of course, everybody can tell, you know, if you say, who are the leaders of corporate America? Well, everybody knows. Ken Lay, he's a disgraced leader, Bernie Ebers, but, you know, it's Jack Welch or GE. We all know the names of these guys. I mean, they're Bill Gates, Steve Jobs. Bernie says, can anybody, and there were a couple hundred people there. He says, can anybody name for me any of the leaders of the working class in America? Nobody, I mean, there was virtually no response. Nobody, I mean, now 30 years ago, everybody would have said, you know, okay, I can tell you, you know, there was Jimmy Hoffa and there was, you know, on the list went, you know, all the labor leaders of the time, Jimmy Hoffa is the most notorious, but there was a time when labor got as much press coverage as did business. It ain't happening anymore. Why would that be? Could it be because large anti-labor multinational corporations have taken over the news industry? I don't know. It's a different topic. Sorry, bumper music got me off on it. Ed from California on the line. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind?
Two leaders. There's one named Bernie and one named Tom.
What's that?
Two leaders of the working men.
Oh, two leaders of the working men. Yeah.
Yeah. Bernie and Tom.
Yeah, Bernie. Well, okay, thank you.
There's also the idea that the idea of the world, one government type of thing. I think we're forgetting the point that there is going to be one, but it's China, not the United States.
Yeah, and the Chinese are very clear about that. I can tell you. In fact, I wrote a chapter about that in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. The Chinese are very clear about that.
Yeah, and they want it, and they're going to get it. We're giving it to them.
Well, that's the thing. It's not so much that they're going to get it as that we're giving it to them, and they're willing to pay the price to get it. And
we're being invaded by Mexico and giving it away to China.
Yeah, I'm not arguing with you, Ed. I think it's a disaster. It's an absolute disaster. And another example of just the tragic loss of democracy in the United States, of leadership, of the voice of we the people being heard in Washington. But we'll keep talking about it here on with the We the People radio show, the Tom Hartman Program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
He's
the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, Live 365's American FM. You can find it all at tomhartman.com, as well as our live chat room, where you can drop in and say hi to the folks there. Just click live chat. It gets you to it. A few small hoops to jump through. You know, you got to register, but that's very simple stuff. And we don't sell email lists and or any of that kind of nonsense. So anyhow, you're welcome to drop by and hang out with some of the finest minds on the entire internet. Talked in the last hour, in the first hour of the program, about Bush, William Pfaff's this article published in The Guardian in the UK. About why Bush will fail in Europe. And he gets into the idea of that part of this visit is that we're coming hat in hand and we're saying, you know, please help us. You know, we've got 140,000 soldiers and we need some help and we're running out of money and we can't afford to pay for this. George has run our country into bankruptcy, essentially. I mean, well, actually, there's no essentially about it. I mean, he's run our country into bankruptcy. And he talks about how the Social Security Fund is going to go bankrupt, flat out broke. While he's creating all these huge deficits, these mind-boggling deficits, this incredible debt that we have. And in any case, we have this, you know, it's just this very, very substantial issue that I would like to get into a little bit later on in the program. But first I want to get into this labor as an issue. We have David Swanson on. David is the media coordinator with the International Labor Communications Association. Hey, David, are you there?
I'm here, Tom. How are you?
Oh, that's great. I'm great. I missed you when you were first on. It didn't show up on my little window here that you were on the line. So I was moving along, changing topics. Great to have you. I don't know if you heard the last little bit of the close of the last hour of the program, but I made. Pardon?
Sorry, I didn't.
Yeah, I figured you probably didn't, but I made the point that this weekend, Bernie Sanders, our congressman here in Vermont, and who's a regular guest in this program, hosted a movie about media consolidation and media control and whatnot here in Montpelier. The movie was called Orwell Rolls Over in His Grave, and it's a marvelous movie. And after it was over, Bernie got up and he made the point that everybody in the room could name the captains of industry in America, the people who represent the ownership class, the top 1% of Americans who own 90% of the wealth of this country, the Jack Welches of GE, the Bill Gates of Microsoft, the Steve Jobs of Apple. You know, we know these names. We know who these people are. Even the disgraced ones, the Ken Lays and the Bernie Ebers and the Martha Stewarts. We know who they are. And then he said, please raise your hand if you can name the leaders of the American working class. And there were 200-300 people in the room. Three people raised their hands. And, you know, he didn't ask them who the names were. I mean, he was just making the point. Nobody knows. And the point is that this stuff just doesn't get covered in the media. And to take it to another step, one step up, and the one that I believe you want to talk about today, this great article that you've written about state minimum wage progress. Nobody even knows who's leading the fight for the minimum wage. Most people don't realize that in many cases it's actually unions who are arguing for a higher minimum wage for non-unionized people. Talk to me about this for a minute here, David.
That's right. It's one of the best things the labor movement is doing, one of the things we're doing right that has hopeful indications for rebuilding the labor movement, and that is that labor is working to build alliances with community groups and religious groups and going out and winning higher living wage and minimum wage laws that cover you whether you're in a union or not, and in most cases don't affect union workers directly at all.
Yeah. David Swanson, by the way, the media coordinator with the International Labor Communications Association. It's ILCA Online. Online, the word O-N-L-I-N-E is part of the URL. ILCAonline.org. And you folks are affiliated with the AFL-CIO as well.
Yes, sir.
And if anybody has any questions about labor or, you know, gee, what can I do or how can I do it, whatever, our phone number 1-866-889-8894. In your article here, you note that 31 states and the District of Columbia are up to something. Tell me what's going on here.
Well, if George W. Bush finishes out his second term, we will have seen 11 years without an adjustment to the federal minimum wage, which loses value every year as the cost of living goes up with inflation. And that will be an all-time record. You know, the previous record was 9 years with the 8 years of Reagan. And
what a surprise.
It's not much of a shock. No.
Yeah, the two most labor-hostile administrations since McKinley.
Right. Right. If not outdoing him, I don't want to judge. But under Reagan, we saw a similar pattern, and we're seeing it now even more so. States and localities are taking matters into their own hands and saying, look, if you're not going to fix the minimum wage, we're going to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And we now have 14 states plus the District of Columbia that have set the minimum wage for all workers in their states higher than the federal level.
So we have states going in and saying, you know, okay, you guys at the up there in Washington, D.C., you're going to say, oh, it's a $5.15 an hour. We're not going to put up with that. We're not going to tolerate that. That is not a living wage. We're not going to have the people in our state living in abject and utter poverty. We'll only have them living in sort of poverty.
That's right. That's right. People who are working full time, rather than having them make $10,000 a year, we're going to make sure they make at least $12,000 or $15,000 a year.
Which is
They're
a start.
They're going to be able to pay a few more bills.
Yeah, I mean, it's a start. I mean, we have to acknowledge it's a start. And the minimum wage, for example, here in Vermont, I believe is $7 an hour. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it is. And so, I mean, which is probably higher than most states. I don't know, but well, you would know. I mean, that's
about typical for states that have set a higher minimum wage. Some are into $8 or $9, and of course, local living wage laws have gotten up to $13 or $14. But
and really,
there's no reason they shouldn't.
Yeah, what communities have $13, $14 living wage laws?
The highest are in California, Fairfax, California, Richmond, California. They're up above $13. And if you look at what the federal minimum wage was back in 1968. And you adjust it for inflation and you adjust it for cost of living, you know, just for inflation, it should be approaching $9 now.
Right.
And if you adjust it for productivity, geez, it's maybe twice that. You know, we're always
close
told
to $20.
It can't go up until productivity does.
Right.
But it has. You know?
Right. Although the productivity numbers are suspicious because very often those productivity numbers include offshore labor, even though they're not offshoring the labor. In other words, there's production being done overseas that's infiltrating those numbers. But still, automation has enhanced productivity, and the American workers are, you know, all the time getting better at what they're doing. I'm curious, the Fairfax, California, for example, these communities that have what the conservatives would consider to be outrageously high minimum wage. I mean, $13. What? You can't run a. How can you have a McDonald's at $13? How can you? They must be fascinating microcosms. Are these communities going down in flames?
Well, I should clarify that there's a difference between a city that has a living wage law that covers certain categories of workers, particularly public workers and workers on public contracts, and a city that has a citywide minimum wage that covers everybody, including McDonald's.
Right.
And there are only four cities that have done that so far: Washington, D.C., Santa Fe, San Francisco, and Madison, Wisconsin. And the last three are really too new to have good data on. D.C. has been around for quite a while and has had no negative impact. But there are 123 cities that have a living wage law affecting some segment of the workforce, and there's extensive documentation, and economists that were opposed to the whole idea have swung around because the evidence is so strong.
It just makes sense. I mean, this
you reduce poverty, You increase local retail purchases because people have money to spend. You increase the tax base.
You know, what's mind-boggling to me, David, is that in this country, from the founding of this country until 1980, everybody understood that if you want to increase prosperity, you give money to poor people because they will spend it. That if you want to stir up business activity, if you want to create opportunities for entrepreneurs, I mean, occasionally our government has even had to do it as the employer of last resort, like Franklin Roosevelt did with the WPA in the 1930s, and hire, you know, people who couldn't find a job anywhere else, and thus give them money in exchange for the work that they're doing, so that they would spend it, and their spending it would create opportunities for people to open businesses to meet those needs. What a surprise! And in 1980, Reagan came along with a screwy idea that George Herbert Walker Bush called voodoo economics, that no, if you give money to the rich, that will enhance economic activity. Screw the poor. It doesn't matter what happens to them. And now we're seeing the results of it for 30 years now, or 20 years, 25 years, and very steadily, ever since Reagan came into power with conservative economics, we have seen a decline, along with the decline in unionization, a decline of the middle class.
That's right. And George W. Bush used that argument for his tax rebates. He said, we're going to put money into the hands of people who need it. They're going to spend it and boost the economy.
Yeah.
But he didn't do what he said. He put money primarily in the hands of the people who didn't need it.
Right.
And it didn't boost the economy.
Well, because they were investing it offshore. I mean, who's keeping their money in dollars right now? I mean, they're buying factories in China, or they're buying euros to stash, under their bed. It's or they're buying gold, or they're buying, you know, the gold riot or something. David, we have about a minute left. I really want to give you a shot at talking about this, your take on this issue here. What's the call for action? What can people do?
People should get involved in a living wage or a minimum wage campaign. A great place to start is acorn.org. But I think that the big picture here is that with states taking this kind of action, we're seeing a different map of the country where there are more states involved than the so-called blue states. And if the Democratic Party picks up, as I think they are, and former Senator Edwards is working on this issue in the states, we may see a change in the Democratic Party such that it begins to talk about liberal economics and gets away from the cultural issues that are forcing people to vote against their economic interests. And
yeah,
this is a very encouraging movement, the living wage movement.
Yeah. So let's wake people up and help them figure out that this is actually good for us all. It's not just the right thing to do. It's not just the moral thing to do. It's not just the traditionally religious thing to do. It's actually good economics. It's very straightforward. David Swanson, thank you so much for being with us. The International Labor Communications Association, the media coordinator, www.ilcaonline.org, your website. And I assume you have links to your article and other sites from there?
Yeah, we do. And you can also go to davidswanson.org, and it's up there, too.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Dave.
Thanks, Tom.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I was burned out from exhaustion, buried in the hail, poisoned in the bushes and blown out on the trail, hunted like a crocodile, ravaged in the corn. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
And welcome back. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And first, maybe I want to drill a little deeper into some of these labor issues. Connecticut is getting into this whole thing with Walmart. But first, let's get our report for the day from Washington, D.C. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line. Hey, Ellen.
You don't even want to get me going on Walmart. You know something? I will not walk in that store.
Yeah, I have that problem, too. I
never bought anything there either.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
bad news. Okay, I think there's two things that are sort of making Washington focus this week. Of course, everybody's out of town. One is whether the president is going to manage to make Europe his top of the agenda and swing them over with his speech today. so far doesn't look so great. Victoria Jones will be joining you tomorrow from Belgium right before she takes off. She is with the president for the next 2 days and will be following, will be giving the European reaction.
Oh, it's marvelous.
So she'll be calling in tomorrow for you.
Great.
The other thing, Tom, that I think people are very focused on is, again, we've been talking about this on and off, but what is press? Who are they? And is traditional press being destroyed? And is the Jeff Gannon thing just the tip of the iceberg?
Yeah.
And honestly, everywhere I have gone in Washington in the last 3 days, that is all anybody talks to. I went to the CPAC, which is the Conservative Action Committee event on Friday night. They did a cocktail party. And that's all anybody could talk about.
Yeah. Well, they have been playing the press like a fiddle on the one hand, the conservatives now, for 20 years, 25 years. And on the other hand, infiltrating it. And on the third hand, bashing it, complaining, criticizing the liberal press. You know, and now it seems that some of these things are coming back to roost. CBS News actually had a story this morning on their website tying Gannon, or Guckert, the prostitute guy who also called himself a reporter, to Karl Rove. I mean,
well, you know, yeah, I saw that.
CBS talking about this? I mean, it's like,
well, finally they're talking about it.
Yeah,
but I'll tell you, I mean, it's very hard to know how much of him was really connected and how much of him was bluster.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I knew him very well, talked to him every day at the White House. I'm going to go slow on saying that he had a direct connection to those guys and was fed what he was going to say to them. Honestly, I don't think Gannon was that clever or that smart.
Oh, really?
Really.
So he knew
him. I mean, you can ask Greg or anybody in my office. Victoria, we all knew him very well.
Yeah, so you think that he was just basically a good old boy conservative, as it were, somebody who they all knew was
on their side, wink, yeah. Not in terms of feeding them and even giving him supposedly that press business on Ambassador Wilson's wife,
right, yeah.
Victoria Plame,
yeah,
whatever.
Valerie Plame, yeah.
Valerie Plame. I don't honestly think so. I'd be very surprised.
Yeah, well, he hasn't been subpoenaed yet, so.
I think they liked him, but I don't think they took him seriously.
Yeah. So, to what extent?
But those are the two main events here in Washington.
Right, but whether or not Gannon Guckert was, you know, inside at the White House, to what extent do you think that the particularly the White House press corps has been infiltrated or is being intimidated by Rove and the Bush administration?
Boy, that's hard to answer. I mean, I think the Bush administration wants this whole thing to go away.
Yeah.
And it's not.
But, I mean, access is everything. I mean, I was watching the coverage this morning on TV of Bush's trip to Europe, and it was like these network reporters were fawning over him.
Well, because if you don't fawn, you don't get access. Why have I not been allowed to ask a question of the president, although we have, obviously, of Ari and later Scott, in 4 years I've been covering him in the White House?
Because they know who you are.
I will never get a question in. I'll be there another 4 years, and I will not get one question in, and I'm there every day.
Because you're a liberal, presumably.
That's right.
Yep.
You got it.
Amazing. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks so much. It's good to hear from you. Talk to you today.
And now for a traffic update, we go to...
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Maybe not the best bumper music to follow a discussion of Jeff Gannon. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 26 and a half minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Interesting. Several interesting topics on the table here today. What's going on in Europe? What's the United States position in the world? What's happening with regard to labor in the United States and the working class, something you don't even hear about anymore in the media? When was the last time you heard a story on a network news show about the working class or about representatives of the working class, whether it be organized labor or somebody just simply speaking out for example, minimum wage reform, things like that. When was the last time? It's been forever for me. I mean, it's just maybe I don't watch enough TV. I don't know. Tom in St. Paul, Minnesota on the line. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Tom, yeah, I don't want to keep harping on this, but I called you Friday and I wanted to speak with David Swanson regarding this branding and marketing the message and framing language in the soundbite culture, since he was the communications guy. And like I said Friday, you know, the Europeans are just astonished of the lack of democracy in the American workplace in a country that trumpets democracy everywhere else in, you know, in society. I mean, half of our waking life is spent in the workplace, and we don't have democracy there, and we should change the name of unions to something that is more marketable, like I said before, you know, democracy lobby or workplace democracy, to drive the point home that we don't have democracy in the half of our waking life.
Yeah, it's well said, Tom. It's well said. It's a good point.
You know, they succeeded in, like, using the words like union bosses, you know, implying that Jimmy Hoffa mafia type thing, right?
Yeah.
You hear him use the word union boss like it's mafia. And we somehow have to market, because, you know, you only have people's attention for like 2 seconds. And to drive the point home that what the Europeans know, that the only way to extend democracy everywhere is through a worker group.
If we want to bring democracy to the world, if it's so important to the Bush administration to bring democracy, if they want to be the great paragons, the great harbingers, the Grim Reaper is what comes to mind, but I'm sure they would say the beacons of the swooping down falcons bringing to mind, whatever it is.
Right.
Then why don't they start in the United States of America, in the American workplace, and give workers a democratic voice
to vote?
To be represented by a union.
And my wife says, you know, we should actually even bypass the unions and just go to your representatives and make it law, like the Wagner Act and stuff like this.
Yeah.
And just like it is in Europe, where I think it's companies larger than 100 employees have to have a worker union representative on the board.
Yeah, well, the way that we sort of put that into the law was with the Department of Labor. Their original purpose was not just to defend the interests of organized labor, but to defend the interests of all workers. And now, you know, Reagan started this policy of using the Department of Labor to destroy labor.
Right.
To work against the interests of labor. And of course, Bush, you know, Elaine Chao and company. I mean, Bush has raised this, elevated this to an art form.
But you don't hear union representatives like David Swanson and them talking about using this tact about spreading democracy in the place where you spend half your life.
Well, I believe, I could be wrong, Tom, but I believe that next week at this same time, you know, more or less, David's going to be back on the program. And if he is, please call in and raise that with him if I forget to.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Will do.
Tom, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number. And Kate in Arcata, California on the line. Hey, Kate, welcome to the program. Kate? Oh, I'm sorry. That's John from New England.
Hey,
got
John.
Got the wrong line. Hey, John.
Hi. Good program as usual.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say, before GWB, I can't call him president because we all know he's not the president. Travels to Europe. I think the European Union should have come out with a joint statement telling them to stay home because it would cause too much disruption and that they couldn't guarantee his safety. And a footnote to that is, remember the boycott of those wonderful French wines?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's all I have to say, Tom.
Yeah, well, it's yeah, okay. Well said.
Thank you.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You very much. Good to hear from you. Good to hear from you, John. See, the unfortunate reality is there's this thing called realpolitik, which is the politics. Actually, I shouldn't say it's the unfortunate reality. Anyhow, realpolitics is the politics of the practical. Henry Kissinger was sort of considered himself the master of it. Of, you know, we'll do what has to be done so that we can get what needs to be done, even if we need to compromise our principles. That's the realpolitik notion. Yes, we'll deal with dictators if that's what it takes to further the interests of our country. On the other hand, on the other extreme, you've got the absolute ideologues who say, no, it's our way or the highway. There is only one form of government which is acceptable. It's ours. This was, for example, the position put forward by Joe Stalin and later by Nikita Khrushchev. And a few briefly lived followers thereof until Gorbachev came along. And oddly, the United States has never taken that position. In fact, quite the opposite. Our position, with a few painful and hopefully learned from exceptions, but by and large, our position throughout history has been, we're going to do it our way. And if you want to try it this way, that's cool. And if you're going to try it some different way, that's fine too. And, you know, we will speak our mind. But we acknowledge that there are other forms of governance. We don't think they're the best. We don't think, you know, some of them are even good. But now you've got this third group that has come along. Okay. So from, which I would call the hypocritic ideologues, Bush being the main cheerleader for them, who say, you know, there's only one form of government that's good, only one form of government that we will tolerate, except for the Saudis and the Pakistanis, which is back to real politic. But they're pretending that it's not real politic. They're pretending that democracy's on a march, freedom's on a march, and yet. At the same time, you know, what is happening is the Europeans who have been through this and they've watched this happen. I mean, they watched us come out of reject the tyranny of the British Empire. And they've been through their own revolutions as well. And they're looking at this going, this is really strange. What is happening here? This, the kind of language that is coming out of this administration, how these people are talking, what they're saying. And a lot of them are like, we don't get it. And how can the United States say with a straight face, and Condi Rice has said this, and Bush, this was the national security policy of the United States, that there can only be one superpower in the world? How can you say that a unipolar world is the only kind of stable world? I mean, didn't Hitler say that? At least when the British Empire was rising, when Queen Elizabeth chartered the British East India Company in 1601, in December of 1601, she did so in large part because the British Empire at that point wasn't much of an empire. And the Dutch trading companies, which had been chartered 100 years or more or less, you know, 70 years, let's say, earlier, were kicking the butts of the British. They were doing really well, and you had the Dutch trading companies that were just they were ripping up the pavement. They were making money. You know, the ships were going all over the place, and you had the Spanish who were bringing all that gold over from North America, and the British were like completely left out of this. And so, you know, Queen Elizabeth got into the act, Queen Elizabeth I, and she died, and King James I inherited that, and on it went. But anyway, she got into the act, and empire came out of this, but at least they had the position of, okay, we're going to compete with the Dutch Empire. We're going to compete with the Spanish Empire. We're going to compete with the Portuguese Empire. We're going to coexist with them. Other than the British and the French, who were continually having wars, but it's another topic. It's just the extraordinary level of hypocrisy which George Bush puts out, changing the reasons for war, changing the positions about war, embracing companies that are among the most tyrannical regimes in the world. Every Friday in Saudi Arabia they have the public executions, the public beheadings, and yet we're not even, I mean, our media doesn't even talk about this. Embracing these Musharraf in Pakistan, who has essentially declared himself president for life, you know, overthrew a democratically elected government. And there was all that discussion after that State of the Union speech. Oh, are all these countries going to start worrying that Bush really means what he says? Well, there's no more discussion about that anymore. Have you noticed? And they don't seem to be all that worried. Could it be that they realize that this was just Bush talking because he was trying to justify his behavior, his illegal behavior in Iraq? Using nice words that we all love, like freedom and democracy. Actually, he didn't use the word democracy. He only used the word democracy once in his speech. Freedom and liberty. Using these words and implying that we are a great moral force in the world with capital force, as opposed to the traditional American ideal of being a great moral beacon to the world. And these countries are going, oh yeah, okay, he's doing the Kissinger thing. He's doing the real politic thing. He's just not honest about it. He's just not telling the people that's what he's up to. I mean, at least during the Cold War, we understood what MAD was, the Mutual Assured Destruction policy, you know, doctrine. It's sometimes I'm aghast. 1-866-889-8894. Let's hear what some of our listeners think about this. Kate in Arcata, California. Hey, Kate.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to give you a little bright news.
Okay.
It was about when you were discussing the labor, very little labor news in the media, which I agree with. But this morning on the Today Show, I think it was Katie Couric who interviewed a woman. I think the organization is called 9to5, and they were talking about the fact that 86% of food workers do not have paid sick days,
mm-hmm.
and that so many of them get fired if they take off time.
Right.
And it just went on and on for probably 10 minutes about the plight of the food workers who just don't
now,
have their needs taken care of.
Kate, I think that's marvelous, but isn't it a little horrifying that let's put this in context here. You're calling a talk show to say, isn't it cool that labor got, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, out of the thousands of hours of news that are programmed for this week, let's say.
Well, you know, that's a point too. But at least there was something out there, and you know, with websites and information and everything, it's, you know, I guess the action to take is to get in touch with NBC and say, great, we want more labor news like that.
Yeah.
That would probably be the positive way to deal with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well said, Kate. Thank you. Contact your media and say, I would really like to know what's going on with the labor movement. Thank you very much. I work for a living. I'd like to know what's going on. Alan, a trucker at a truck stop. Hey, Alan, what's up?
If I was listening to a channel called Wisdom Channel on Sirius Radio the other day,
uh-huh.
and they mentioned something by Confucius, I think it's written about 2,500 years ago.
Yeah, Confucius, yeah.
They said, never give a man a sword who can't dance.
Yeah.
I thought it pretty well describes these people as running our country now, because they don't know religion and they're using religion to their advantage.
Yeah. Yeah. And tragically, the religion can be a great force to bind people together, to bring people together, and instead it's being used as a force. What the Bush administration has done, they're using it as a force to divide us. What the Bush administration has done is they have gone through and found those parts of the Bible, for example, that can be used to divide us from each other and emphasize those. And unlike, for example, Lyndon Johnson and Franklin Roosevelt, who also talked about religion, and went into the Bible and found those parts of the Bible that could be used to bring us together. The idea of caring for the poor, of having compassion for others, of the obligation that we have, the moral obligation that we have to lift up our brothers and sisters who are in crisis or danger or tragedy. This is so sad. Alan, thanks for the call and thanks for the comment.
Thank you.
It's well said. I appreciate it. Armin in Florida on the line. Hey, Armin, what's up?
Two questions. One question, why do they always talk about inflation when the little people, when the working class, wants an increase in minimum wage or workers, you know, at the bottom of the scale? Why do they always talk about how inflationary it is and everything and how negative and portray it that way, but they never give equal credence to the, in the media, to the CEOs and their exorbitant wages. And
well, if you let me ask you, Armin, if you worked for GE, would you, and for which owns NBC, would you criticize Jack Welch when he was chairman?
Would I?
If you wanted to keep,
I probably would.
Well,
Then
you probably wouldn't be employed there very long.
Well, then that would be all right, because I wouldn't want to be employed there. If they call themselves news and they don't allow me to do the news, I wouldn't want to be there.
Yeah, and that demonstrates the problem. It's
one other point.
Sorry, Armin, we're out of time, but it's a multidimensional problem as well. It's not just GE and NBC. It's not just the companies in fact, they're not even the problem, in my opinion. It is a system which our politicians have allowed to exist that creates this situation.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Round here, we always stand up straight. Round here, something radiates.
And welcome back. See, here's how it works. And Armin raised this question and this issue, and I think it's a really good one. This is a really important one. This is part of the corruption, not only of the media, but of business overall. For example, let me just give you an example. It's outside the realm of the media, but it's the exact same issue. The Department of Labor recently discovered that Walmart, gee, what a surprise, was violating child labor laws. And they cut this sweetheart deal with Walmart, and they said, we will notify you in advance before we come do any inspections so that you can shred documents and, you know, get the illegals out the back door and clean things up and be all ready for us. Everything, you know, we'll notify you in advance. Well, the state of Connecticut says, sorry, that might be okay at the federal level if you guys want to sell out to Walmart, but we're not going to here in the state of Connecticut, excuse me. Connecticut's governor, this is an article from ABC News by Charles Herman, Connecticut's governor ordered inspections of Walmart stores as the state's attorney general accused the U.S. Department of Labor of cutting a, quote, sweetheart deal, end quote, with a retailing giant on child labor law violations. Now, here's where it gets problematic. Walmart, if they can cut this deal with the government that gives them advance warning, that increases shareholder value. That increases their profitability. That's what corporations are supposed to do. If a media outlet is you know, sucking up to the president in order to get access to the White House, and that's probably not the best example, but that's going to make them more competitive in the marketplace because they have access to the president. That's what they're supposed to do. So what we have is a system that is broken. And the advocates for this broken system are advocates for what is called laissez-faire capitalism, which is absolutely unregulated and unrestrained. They love the word deregulation. They think it's a good thing. Occasionally, deregulation is a good thing. There are a lot of regulations that are absurd. But there are points where we say, no, if you're going to do business, you're going to do it in a way that benefits we the people, as well as makes you a pile of money. It is possible to have both. And that's historically what we've done in the United States, and we're getting away from that now. And if we don't speak up, you and I, if we the people don't speak up, it's going to continue to just slide right out of control, and democracy will be gone. Contact your legislators. Write letters to the editor. Call your talk shows. Do it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
How can there be...
calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. On this day in history, in 1965, Malcolm X was assassinated. In New York City, it happened. As the History Channel notes, Malcolm X, an African-American nationalist and religious leader, was assassinated by rival black Muslims while addressing his organization of Afro-American Unity at the Audubon Ballroom in Washington Heights. He was born Malcolm Little, was his name, in Omaha, Nebraska, in 1925, son of James Earl Little, a Baptist preacher, who advocated the black nationalist ideals of Marcus Garvey. Threats from the KKK forced the family to move to Lansing, Michigan, where his father continued to preach his controversial sermons despite continuing threats. In 1931, his father was brutally murdered by the white supremacist Black Legion, and Michigan authorities refused to prosecute those responsible. In 1937, Malcolm was taken from his family by welfare caseworkers. By the time he reached high school, he had dropped out of school and moved to Boston, where he became increasingly involved in criminal activities, unfortunately. But he pulled himself together, I don't want to go through the whole story of Malcolm X, but his life and his autobiography, which is an extraordinary and moving book, his life is such an extraordinary chronicling of the transitions that happened in the 20th century, of the outrages that were visited upon African Americans in this country in long after the Civil War, long after Reconstruction, or long after the Emancipation Proclamation, long after the passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And of course, largely as a result of the Supreme Court of Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, the Supreme Court decision that established apartheid in the United States, and didn't get reversed until 1954 in Brown versus Board of Education. But Malcolm X, one of those who helped awaken us all collectively. Although he was perceived by many as a very polarizing figure, myself included, I think he had a very important message, and he brought it at a critical time. So here's a fascinating little tidbit from today's New York Times. Remember the Swift Boats Veterans for Truth? They presented themselves, and the media did such a marvelous job of kind of going along with this, of saying, yeah, these Swift Boat Veterans, they're just a bunch of guys who are really upset because they got dissed by John Kerry. You know, they were out there on those Swift Boats, and John Kerry was too, and they know that he's just making this stuff up, and he shot himself in the foot, and he had some shrapnel on his butt, and that wasn't enough, or whatever. You know, they were characterized as this little band of truth seekers. Well, now we find that a lobbying group called USA Next is going to spend $10 million. Now, this seems unrelated, but I'm going to tie this together for you in just a second. They're going to spend as much as $10 million, according to this article by Glenn Justice in today's New York Times, $10 million on commercials and other tactics attacking the American Association of Retired Persons. Well, this is interesting. We have a lobbying group that's going to attack the AARP. They got big bucks. Who are they hiring to do it? To help set their strategy, they've hired Chris LaCivita, an enthusiastic former Marine who advised Swift Vets and POWs for Truth, formerly known as Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, on its media campaign and helped write its potent commercials. Those commercials that were later, some of them, demonstrated to contain outright lies. Or, let's say, implied lies. The guy's saying, I served with John Kerry in Vietnam. not meaning that they had that they were even within 100 miles of him, but they just happened to be in Vietnam the same year. Anyhow, Chris La Civita earned $30,000 for that. They're also hiring Rick Reed, a partner in Stevens Reed, Curcio and Popham, a firm that was hired by Swift Vets and was paid more than $276,000 to do media production for the Swift Vote Veterans Group. For public relations, USA Next has turned to Creative Response Concepts, a Virginia firm that represented both Swift Boat Vets and Regenery Publishing, the publisher of Unfit for Command. They were paid $165,000. Now, hang on just a second. We've got a PR firm in Virginia. We've got a firm, a media production firm. Doesn't say where they're located. We've got a consultant. This group, it's like the old gang is being pulled together again. Now, why? To attack the American Association of Retired Persons. Now, why that? Because the AARP is opposing privatization of Social Security. So what we're discovering now is that the veterans in the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth were just the MacGuffin, to use the old movie phrase. Alfred Hitchcock came up with this phrase called the MacGuffin. The MacGuffin is the, you know, throughout the movie North by Northwest, throughout this entire movie, they're chasing each other. You know, there's this box, right? And they're chasing on trains and on cars, and they're killing people, and you never find out what's in the box. It doesn't matter. It was the MacGuffin. It's like the device used to move the movie along, the plot device. Turns out, it looks like, I mean, if this is true, that the veterans were just, you know, the suckers who kind of went along, and that this fairly efficient group of hit guys was put together to take down John Kerry. And now we have this lobbying group, USA Next, going to hand off $10 million for commercials and other tactics assailing AARP. You just watch. Soon you are going to start seeing the American Association of Retired Persons being attacked in the media. Now, what would they be attacked for? I would guess that they would probably start out where I would start out, which is that the AARP makes most of their money selling insurance that fills in for Medicare, and the AARP was shilling for the administration on Medicare. And now they're opposed to the administration. So they're gonna portray the AARP as corrupt in that regard, would be my guess. Because in my opinion, they were. But they're gonna do like they did with John Kerry. They're gonna take that one issue, that Medicare issue, the AARP getting, you know, most of their, or much of their revenue from selling insurance. The AARP is as much an insurance company as anything else. Like the NRA is as much a lobbying group as it is a membership organization. It's sponsored by some fairly large weapons companies. The AARP is mostly an insurance company. That's my guess is number one that they're going to do. They're going to go after the personality of the AARP. Maybe they'll go after Minnelli, the head of the AARP, who I was not kind to when they were supporting the so-called Medicare reform that created that donut hole where government is not allowed to negotiate prices of drugs, so you and I and our taxes are paying huge, huge fees. Billions, hundreds of billions of dollars that are going via our federal government into the pockets of the pharmaceutical companies. And surprise, surprise, Billy Towson, who shepherded this legislation through, is now making $2 million a year after he left Congress as, you know, a head lobbyist for these folks. So millions, hundreds of millions of our dollars you know, going through, and leaving this donut hole where some insurance company might be able to sell insurance to its member. You know, it was, in my opinion, it wasn't altogether on the up and up. A lot of people have still not forgiven the AARP. Maybe the AARP is trying to redeem themselves. Maybe they were just acting in their own best interests. Maybe, who knows? But I find it fascinating that, well, as the headline of the article, a new target for advisors to Swift vets, that these guys have the art of going in for the kill down, and so they're going to hire them. Remarkable. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number, tomhartmann.com, the website, if you'd like to drop into our chat room. Preston in Denver is on the line. Hey, Preston, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. They do have the art of character assassination down very well, but we can respond. And I thought that, you know, regarding Swift vets and Kerry, that film Going Up River was a great response. I didn't see it during the campaign, but just recently I found the DVD real cheaply on Amazon and was really impressed. And
yeah, the problem is nobody saw it during the campaign.
Yeah,
nobody saw it. I mean, you didn't have like a Sinclair out there going, oh, we're going to put this on the air.
That's true. They just had it at a couple theaters here in Denver and a few others around the country.
Yeah. It showed no place that I could drive to because I was looking for it. I wanted to see the movie. And I tried to watch the video clip on the web, and apparently their servers were so loaded or they were being hit by, you know, spam attackers or whatever so often, I could never get it to load.
So. Well, I saw that Soros and some other wealthy liberals were going to be investing some more money into a liberal media infrastructure, and hopefully they'll be buying some TV stations.
That would be interesting.
Yes, it would. And regarding media and labor, I actually came upon an excellent film called Bread and Roses, starring Adrian Brody, who won the Academy Award for The Pianist.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically a great advertisement for Justice for Janitors and SEIU.
Hmm.
And I had never heard of it.
Bread and Roses.
Upon it at the library.
Interesting.
I'd highly recommend
this
it.
This is a video you can rent now. It's a movie that you can rent in the video stores.
Yeah, Bread and Roses.
Or
probably
from your
not at many video stores, but you can get it at, I think Netflix might have it, or you know, Amazon sells it, and I found it at the library.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the media work that we need to do is, you know, we can criticize the corporate media for a lot of things, and they're going to be doing a lot of hit pieces on about every single civic group imaginable, but we can create and contribute and subscribe to our own media.
Yeah, and that's largely happening on the internet right now, and it's beginning to infiltrate into mainstream media. In fact, as you know, for example, the largest distributor of liberal talk radio in the country right now is Clear Channel Communications. I mean,
interesting.
Go figure. You can make money at it. God bless them.
Yeah.
Preston, thanks for the call. I appreciate
thanks,
it. Good to hear from you. 20 minutes past the hour. I guess I better.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
People try to put us to death.
Talking about my generation.
Just because we get around.
And because we're getting older. And pretty soon you're going to need Medicare. Yeah, the baby boomers are taking it on the chin, I'll tell you. Well, and now we have, it's not just Medicare. Now we have Medicaid. You know, there's a difference. Medicare is the federal program. And Medicaid is the general umbrella name for the programs that are run by the states, where the states kick in a lot of the money, and some money comes from the federal government, but most of it's coming from the states. And Frank, we ought to get somebody on who's really an expert on this, because I'm not. But about the intricacies of it, or maybe it's more than you want to know. But in any case, Medicaid, these state programs, are going in the tank, and they're going in the tank for two reasons. One, medical costs are exploding. And, you know, lawsuits have nothing to do with it. As we know from the statistics and from the information out there, medical costs, lawsuits, whether it's medical malpractice or, you know, of all sorts, lawsuits, constitute less than 1% of the total cost, the total increase in the cost of medical services and expenses. And yet, the cost of medical coverage and expenses are going up 10, 12, 14, 16%, depending on where you are in the country, every year. Why? Well, you know, part of it is that the insurance companies made bad investments in the stock market and they're recovering them now. That's one of the main reasons why the malpractice insurance rates are going up, which is helping drive up medical costs. But another part of it is that the pharma industry and the hospital industry, the private drug companies, the private hospital companies, and the private health insurance companies are just making out like bandits. They've got us over a barrel. And they're squeezing blood out. They're saying, that's it. You know, you want medical services? Oh, you don't have insurance? You get to pay twice the price of everybody else. And how do you get insurance? Well, you got to have a job. And what kind of, but only a particular kind of job. And on it goes. So a lot of people fall through the cracks. They're not eligible for that kind of coverage. And so they end up in these state Medicaid programs. We have one that's a very generous one here in the state of Vermont, where every child in the state within 150% of the poverty level is pretty much covered. I think well over 90-95% of our children in the state, for example, are covered. One of Howard Dean's, you know, one of the things he's proud of that he did as governor. Well, now, as a result of Bush's proposed cuts to Medicaid, and his pushes for even larger cuts. I mean, he wants to cut down on the amount of federal support for these state programs. We have governors who are both Democrats and Republicans coming together and saying, enough, George. We know you've got to pay for your war. We know you've got to give money to the pharmaceutical companies. We know you've been in debt big time to the big banking industries and Wall Street. They've contributed heavily to your campaign. And we'll, you know, the Republicans, governors are saying, and we'll support you in trying to privatize Social Security and, you know, so that you can pay back the financial services industry. And we supported you with Medicare so that you could pay back the drug companies for all the money that they gave you. And we've been supporting your war in Iraq and you can pay back the oil company, but we're not going to support you in cutting Medicaid, excuse me. And now, as Robert Tanner notes, the Associated Press, they're hoping to convince Congress and the Bush administration that they should be given, they being the governors, both Democrats and Republicans, more freedom to alter the $300 billion federal state safety net. Many stress that while cutting costs, they also want to broaden access to health care. Tom Vilsack, for example, the Democratic governor of Iowa, says Medicaid as it currently exists is non-sustainable in the long run. If you do the numbers, they just don't add up. Gee, that sounds familiar. But this is a real crisis. What's George's answer going to be? Cut off the money to the states, and then the governors have to go to their people and say, well, I'm sorry, we're going to have to cut you. And nobody realizes it was Bush who did it. Nice work if you can get it, right? 29 minutes past the hour.
A party.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
There's something wrong with the world today. I don't know what it is. Something's wrong with our eyes.
I would say it's that we've lost sight of the ideals of the founders of this country who said there have been three historic tyrannies. Historically, three groups have tyrannized human beings and under the rubric, under the name of leadership. They have been warlord kings.
So we're going to rule you because we have the weapons to do so.
There have been the warlord kings. There have been the theocrats, those who said that they were going to rule because they knew exclusively what God or the gods wanted. and how we should behave thereby. And there were the rich, the feudal rich. This is a system called feudalism. This was probably the main system in Europe for most of the last 1,000 years. The high point of feudalism being in 1215, when the feudal lords forced King John to sign the Magna Carta. And the founders looked at this and they said, you know, historically, these groups, the landowners, or as the Industrial Revolution came along, the company owners, the business owners, the landowners, the rich, the feudal lords, the church or churches or synagogues or mosques or whatever, you know, the theocrats, I would say in modern history, it's been pretty much churches and mosques. I don't know about the history of Hinduism. Certainly, we haven't seen any Buddhist, popes arising, and Judaism left that behind a few 1,000 years ago, the era of the kings. So in any case, so we've got the feudal lords, the theocrats, and the kings, and they were the sole holders of the rights. They were the only ones who said that, you know, they had the, and we the people, the serfs, the average, you know, the average working guy, the average person, had only privileges. And those privileges were determined by the feudal lords or by the theocrats or by the warlord kings. And the founders of this country said, we're going to flip that upside down. And we the people. I mean, this is how they opened the Constitution. Those are the first three words of the preamble to the Constitution. We the people. Not we the government. We the people are going to create an institution which will have only privileges, not rights. In fact, we're going to very narrowly limit those privileges. We're going to define them in this Constitution. And we the people will be the sole holders of the rights. And we're going to say that when any institution rises up and says that, you know, is whatever, that they want to do A, B, or C, that they are claiming rights or privileges, that we will define what the limits of their privileges will be. So if some of we the people want to get together and form a church, that's cool. But, you know, here's what they can do, here's what they can't do. If we the people want to get together and form a labor union, if we the people want to get together and form a company, if we the people want to get together and form a civic club, whatever it may be, we the people, respecting the rights of the minorities, this being a republic, but a democracy as well, we the people will define what those rights are. And just, you know, very straightforward. And we are losing, and we the people are watching that slip away. And this concerns me tremendously, that we are watching this thing just slip right through our fingers. For example, this from the National Resources Defense Council. Now, admittedly, a group who has a bias. They are in favor of protecting the environment. Therefore, they would be perceived by the Bush administration, which doesn't think of Ken Lay as a special interest, as a special interest. So let's just put that right out there. Press release they just sent out, National Resources Defense Council. The Environmental Protection Agency is illegally negotiating secret agreements with industry lobbyists over pesticide regulation. According to a lawsuit filed February 17th by NRDC, National Resources Defense Council. I thought the Environmental Protection Agency was supposed to be protecting our environment and us. Illegally negotiating secret agreements with industry lobbyists? The EPA's secret backroom deals with pesticide makers, says NRDC attorney Aaron Colangelo. The EPA's secret backroom deals with pesticide makers are clearly against the law, and they're a threat to our health. He says EPA is required to make independent decisions on pesticide safety instead of negotiating deals with the chemical industry. Now, what are they talking about? Mostly atrazine. The lawsuit specifically cites, again, reading from the press release, the lawsuit specifically cites private agreements between the agency. Now, keep in mind, the agency is supposed to represent we the people. The lawsuit specifically cites private agreements between the agency and chemical companies over the regulation of atrazine, one of the most heavily used weed killers in the country, and DDVP, a highly toxic insecticide, which is, by the way, a neurotoxin. It's derived from that class of chemicals that were developed during World War II as nerve gases and paralyzed people, caused damage to their nervous system. Very small quantities, they do the same thing to insects and so. DDVP is one of those, you know, in that category. According to government records obtained by the NRDC through the Freedom of Information Act, I'm telling you, the Bush administration's next assault is going to be on the Freedom of Information Act. They've already pushed back on it considerably over the last 5 years. As we can see with the Cheney Task Force, I mean, they've taken this thing all the way to the Supreme Court, saying, no, you are not entitled to know what the government of We the People is doing behind closed doors in Cheney's meetings with Ken Lay, where they were deciding back in 2001, before 9/11, which oil companies they were going to sell the oil in Iraq to. But I digress. EPA officials, according to the lawsuit, EPA officials met secretly more than 40 times with representatives from atrazine's main manufacturer, Syngenta, while the agency was evaluating the weed killer's toxicity. Ultimately, the agency allowed atrazine to stay on the market, even though the chemical has contaminated drinking water sources across the country. They go on to say that the EPA has been involved in private negotiations. You know, does anybody remember Teapot Dome? I mean, nobody alive remembers Teapot Dome, in all probability, but, you know, where Albert Fall, or was it Fell, the Secretary of the Interior, was taking bribes to let the oil companies lease oil from an area called Teapot Dome out west. I believe it was in Wyoming. I mean, it was like a huge scandal. It was a huge scandal. Well, it was a huge scandal because back then we had a press that was reporting on these kinds of things. Why is it, you may ask yourself, that a major lawsuit against the EPA by a large, I mean, National Resources Defense Council is not, you know, a little fringe group of six guys who just decided to start something last week in some little town in Vermont. No, this is a substantial organization that has credibility and funding and members. And now we hear all about SpongeBob SquarePants being gay in the media. We hear about that for a whole week. But how many times have you heard? Now this lawsuit was filed on February 17th. Today is the 21st. So it's been, what was it, 5 days? 18, 19, 20, 24 days? I can't do math that fast in my head. How many times have you heard about this? Count over the next week, over this continuum. Here we are in the beginning of a news week. It's Monday. Notice on Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday and Friday, just notice how often in the media you hear about this story about the EPA being sued by the National Resources Defense Council, the NRDC. The EPA, they say, it has also been involved in private negotiations with the chemical company Amvec over the status of the insecticide DDVP, that chlorovos, which it sells under a number of trade names, including No Pest Strips. These negotiations, asserts the National Resources Defense Fund in their lawsuit, these negotiations violate EPA's regulations and federal law. We're talking about a violation of federal law by a federal agency and the pesticide industry. The law was specifically the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, the National Advisory Committee Act, and the Freedom of Information Act. NRDC Senior Attorney Eric Olson says these deals are bad for public health, bad for the environment, and bad for democracy. It all does come back together. Also noted that more than 20 years ago, NRDC sued the agency for similar widespread violations committed under EPA Administrator Ann Gorsuch. After Gorsuch and other EPA officials resigned amid allegations of improper industry influence, William Ruckelshaus replaced Gorsuch and settled the case in 1984, agreeing to strict regulations that forbid secret meetings and private deal-making. Olson says EPA is apparently back to its old bad habits. Those 1983 regulations require open and transparent decision-making when the EPA is registering high-risk pesticides or has replaced them in special review, which calls for prompt evaluation of their safety. Gee, I wonder why. Might we have some interest in whether or not there's something out there that could kill us? These regulations forbid the EPA from making a final decision based on negotiations with industry and require the agency to make such decisions independently. See, they're supposed to be representing we the people, not the kings, not the theocrats, and not the feudal lords. But it ain't how it works in the Bush administration. In addition, they point out in this news release, if the agency establishes a group of outside advisors, the Federal Advisory Committee Act requires it to create a balanced advisory committee that meets in the open and is not inappropriately influenced by any special interest. Today's suit charges that EPA has ignored these requirements in its atrazine and DDVP negotiations. Now, here's where it gets really wild. Have you eaten in a Mexican restaurant recently? Had any corn chips? Had a tortilla? Have you eaten a candy bar recently, sweetened with corn syrup? Have you drank a Coke or a Pepsi or any other soft drink sweetened with corn syrup recently? If so, you might want to pay some attention to these hearings because the National Resources Defense Council says, and I quote, atrazine is used on most of the corn and sugar cane grown in the United States. Oh, and by the way, do you drink your water? Do you drink the water out of the tap? And has been detected in the drinking water of more than a million Americans at levels higher than the EPA safety standard. Scientific studies have found that atrazine can damage the reproductive system and cause higher rates of cancer. Oh, they're just being hysterical. Those environmentalists, those people, they're just being hysterical. They want us to have, must just be those wacky environmentalists, right? No, I'm sorry. The European Union just banned atrazine because of pervasive drinking water contamination. What is going on? And are you going to hear about it? Am I going to hear? Are we going to hear about it in the news? Somehow I doubt it. Alice in Humboldt County, California on the line. Hey, Alice, welcome to the program.
Our government is so bad, Tom, and it's getting worse all the time. And we have been wondering if there is anything at all that we can do about this. What I know is that on the 19th of next month, we are going to have a peace march here in Eureka. And I think we can all get involved in that and try to let them know that we know what they are up to.
That's marvelous. Alice Rama notes on his comment to me here in our computer communication that you're 91 years old. I salute you.
Okay.
I salute you. Granny D is a good friend of mine, Doris Haddock, and who walked across the United States on her 90th birthday for campaign finance reform.
Yeah.
You are one of our wise elders, Alice, and I am very grateful that you are
here
with us. Thank you so much for sharing that. And tell us again, where and when is the meeting? Oh, I think Alice is gone. Okay. Thank you for the call, Alice. Great to hear from you. I really and truly do appreciate it. And let us know how that meeting went, by the way. Before I go to Mike's call here, I just have to tell you a quick story. I was in Australia a couple of years ago. This was maybe 6-8 years ago. And a friend of mine, Jeff Guest, up in North Queensland, had taken me up to meet an Aboriginal elder by the name of King Tommy George. And we're sitting in this dry riverbed, and King Tommy George is telling me about how the highest secrets can only be told to a person whose all his hair is white. And Tommy George's hair is totally white. He's got this nimbus. He's a very old man. And I said, wow, can you tell me what some of those secrets are? And, of course, all of my hair is not white. And King Tommy George's eyes got really wide, and he said, very serious, he said, if I told you those secrets without your hair being white, you could burst into flames. The Aboriginals really get it that our elders hold wisdom for us and that they're so important to our society. Alice, I honor you. 10 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
They sell us the president the same way. They sell us our clothes and our cars. They sell us everything from youth to religion. The same time they sell us our war. I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance.
On the wire. Who are those men in the shadows who can be depended upon to tell us that we have to go fight and die? Oh, Jackson Browne, what a marvelous, marvelous artist and performer. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Mike in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Well, you and I are about the same age, and I'll bet you dollars and donuts that you watch Star Trek, the original one.
Yeah, when I was a kid.
And I think part of the problem that we're having in this country was reflected in one of the Star Trek episodes where Kirk and company stumbled upon this group of barbarians who venerated this piece of paper. They couldn't even pronounce what was on it. And it wasn't until the end of the show.
I remember. It was the Constitution.
The United States.
Yeah, I remember that episode. You know, it's interesting how the early Star Wars, Star Trek programs were always morality plays. You know, I haven't watched one in probably 15, 20 years, maybe longer, but my recollection of them back then is that they were always morality plays. There was always a moral at the end. There was always an aha and a you know, there was some lesson to be learned from them.
Well,
the old Gunsmoke movies were as well. I mean, you know, that was just.
Well, with Star Trek, that came from Roddenberry, who was a decorated World War II veteran and a retired cop.
Mm-hmm.
And he put what he had seen in real life, much like Rod Serling, he put that into his programs.
Yeah.
And the problem with us is that we sit here and blither and blather about the Constitution. Most people haven't read it.
Yeah. Well, it's not easy reading, Mike. I mean, you have to acknowledge that. It's not particularly long, and it's not particularly difficult, but it's not really easy reading. You have to give some thought to it. It's written in large part by lawyers, and it's law. I mean, it is the law.
Yeah.
But if people would simply read the preamble, which is, you know, a paragraph or so, and then read the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, I think that would be a good beginning point. That's something you can get through in 15 minutes.
Exactly. And it really isn't that difficult. Yes, you have to actually concentrate. You can't. It's not light reading. But it's not that difficult to understand.
Yeah.
It's accessible if you sit there and think about it. And yet we don't do that. And we don't. And because of that, we don't value the wonderful government that was given to us. And that is why you have people venerating idiots like Bush as a king.
Or treating him like a king, yeah. It's, I don't disagree, Mike. One of the places where we have gone wrong, unfortunately, is so much in our school systems, is we're simply not teaching this stuff. We're not talking about it. enough, in my opinion, on things like talk radio, in our media. It's just the American history has been lost. What I get is that people are so hungry to get it back. Mike, thanks for the call.
Thank you, Tom.
Good to hear from you. I do appreciate it. People so want to know, what are the founding ideals of this country? How does that work? What would Jefferson do, for example? Yeah, we'll talk about it every day. See you tomorrow. Thanks for being with us today.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.